With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, my name is Stuart Miles and welcome to the Pocketlint podcast. This week saw the launch of Google streaming service Stadia. The new offering from the search giant will let you play games at home or on the go without the need to buy a big expensive console. Is it the future of gaming? Pocketlint's Rick Henderson has been playing with the new service to find out and joins us to tell us more later. Meanwhile, I've been chatting with Andy Kerr, Director of Product Marketing at Bowers & Wilkins, the speaker company based in the south of England, to talk about how important having good speakers are and how the company went about developing the sound system for the new Philips OLED Plus 984 TV. Apocalypse Reviews editor Mike Lowe walks us through the new Motorola Razr, having played with the new foldable smartphone at an exclusive event in Los Angeles ahead of the UK launch. Is it one to put on your shopping list, or should the phone really have remained in the history books? But first, to you, Rick, why don't you start by telling us what Stadia does and how it actually works?
Right. Well, Stadia is a cloud gaming platform, and what that effectively means is that rather than host games locally on a games console or a PC, the games are hosted on a server somewhere else in the world. And what happens is you play the game using a dedicated controller, press the button goes down the internet, hits the server over in Canada or hopefully a bit closer to home, and the video of the game actually comes back to your TV or mobile device. So therefore, for all intents and purposes, it looks exactly like you're playing the game at home, but it's actually played elsewhere.
And I suppose Google can offer this sort of improved latency and all the other stuff, because we've seen streaming services before, but they've kind of always failed. But I presume Google is saying, well, look, they've got all this massive infrastructure that they're using for all the search stuff, and therefore we'll just plug in the games, and that means that it solves a lot of the problems from other things.
Yeah, the one thing about Google Stadia from our tests is that the latency is very low. Previous services that I've played, like Sony's PlayStation Now and the failed OnLive, they had really quite bad lag and latency issues where when you press the button, there's a distinct delay between the you pressing the button and the actual action performing on screen. Whereas with Google Stadia, it doesn't do that. It's actually incredibly effective. It feels like that you're playing it on a games console in many ways, which actually reduces latency. There's another way that Stadia reduces latency in the fact that it comes with a dedicated controller that directly links to the internet. It doesn't link to your mobile or, well, your Chromecast Ultra, which is the only device it really works on at the moment. It doesn't link to that directly. So the latency between the controller and the device is no longer important. It's basically, it's just grabbing that information and sending that information from the cloud.
Now, you've been playing it, and what are the games like? I mean, are they console ready? Do you feel that you were playing a console?
There is a slight difference between playing a game on Stadia and playing it directly on a console, but only hardcore gamers would really notice the difference. That's what I've found. I have, as full disclosure, I have very good broadband. I have 350 megabits per second broadband and running at between 11 and 13 milliseconds of ping, which means that the latency I experience and the lag I experience is very, very good. And I haven't experienced any stutter whatsoever when my Chromecast Ultra is plugged in through Ethernet. So I ran Destiny 2, for example, which is one of the launch games on Stadia, through both the PS4 Pro and through Stadia, and I could barely tell the difference. I genuinely could barely tell the difference. It was running in 4K HDR on both. Wow. In fact, on Stadia, it was running in 60 frames per second and wasn't on the PS4 Pro, which is quite extraordinary in many respects. But the one thing that I would say is that your video performance will be dependent on your broadband speed and the bandwidth that you experience. If you're running it wireless, other people are using the internet in your household, you might experience lesser performance in terms of video quality.
So there's lots of caveats because, then, in that sense of, yeah, you're not going to be playing this on the train on your Pixel.
Essentially, see this as Netflix.
Now, one of the questions I have is about games. Now, I know that there's been some criticism from some of the other reviewers that obviously the collection of games available hasn't been huge. We saw that with Nintendo Switch, and we both discussed this previously and said that, you know, that hasn't really bothered the Switch users out there. That said, Google is not a games company. Microsoft, obviously, has the Xbox, is a games company, makes their own games. Sony has their PlayStation, makes their own games. Is that going to be a problem for Stadia in the future?
Well, yes, is a simple answer in the fact that it's going to, that Google seems to have launched a year too early if it wanted to launch with its own first party games. It has set up its own games development studios, and is currently working feverishly on its own games and is ploughing a lot of money into that. So we can start to see its own games probably towards the end of 2020. But the big thing for me, though, and it has got a very small library of games available from the off, and I'm not overly keen on its pricing structure and the way that works, in the fact that their games are priced towards console equivalents, which I think is a lot of money considering you don't technically own the game. But the actual suite of games that it has now and are coming soon is pretty impressive anyway, because it has Red Dead Redemption 2, it has Destiny 2, Cyberpunk 2077 is coming, Football Manager, I'm a massive Football Manager fan, so that's, you know, I like the fact that I can play that on my TV.
And so currently the third party, you know, the Ubisofts of this world, the, you know, the Rockstars have signed up and said, you know, yes, we'll support this and we'll go for it.
Yeah, they've got all the big boys apart from EA at the moment. So they've definitely got the games coming or on the platform already. It's 22 games, launch games is not a massive amount. But like you said earlier, the Switch launched with probably less than that. At the same time, is it, unless you've got a really brilliant gaming PC, you can't play Red Dead Redemption 2 at this quality anywhere else. It's a launch platform. People seem to forget that. And retrospectively forget what happened when other launch platforms arrived. Genuinely, I think we've got to give it a chance. The one caveat I would say is that if you already own a games console, there is absolutely no reason to upgrade to Stadia. It's not for you.
And so the final question is that sense of, so we've obviously got Stadia from Google. Microsoft's xCloud is not here yet. It's coming. It's still in kind of preview beta mode, isn't it?
Yeah, it's got a preview mode, but it is coming in 2020 to pretty much every region. That's the big one to look forward to, because that one promises a lot of... The business model seems to be better with xCloud, in the fact that if you own... Basically, you'll be able to play all of your own Xbox games that you've ever bought on xCloud for free. Plus, you'll also be able to use your Games Pass Ultimate subscription. So all the games that are available there will also be available on xCloud. So that'll be a real game changer, I think. Pardon the pun.
Still to come, Mike talks to us about the new Motorola Razr.
So it's, you know, obviously it's, in essence, it's twice the size that a phone could be, but they've been quite scrupulous about getting it down to a sensible enough size.
Bowers & Wilkins has been making speakers for over 50 years. Whether it's the top-of-the-range, eye-catching Nautilus speakers or something more affordable, the company is known for its excellent sound credentials. But with more of us wanting to embrace sound in all aspects of our life, the company has looked to bringing the B&W experience beyond the traditional speaker in partnerships with companies like McLaren and Philips. I sat down with Andy Kerr, Director of Product Marketing at Bowers & Wilkins, to talk about the challenges of creating great sound, how important is it to support audio platforms like Dolby Atmos in the future, and how you go about creating a sound system to a TV when you're told that the speaker can't be that big. I started asking what consumers need from a sound system connected to your TV today.
If you look at the evolution of viewing over the course of the last 15 to 20 years. I mean, we all recall, well, certainly I do, the mid-90s of kind of the advent of flat panels, when up until that point, you know, the cathode ray tube was the dominant force. And, you know, TV sets were huge, huge devices. I mean, I vividly remember kind of attempting to review in my former job a 32-inch Sony Vega CRT, which was one of those square tube things. And you know, it weighed nearly 100 kilograms. I mean, it was just an astonishing thing. Of course, the thing about having that much real estate inside the cabinet, inside the enclosure, meant that there was a significant amount of space to put other things in there too, not the least of which were decent-sized drive units. So I don't think most people buying TVs in the mid-90s were overly claiming that, you know, they didn't sound very good. The minute we've moved to the flat panel world, you know, space constraints are the issue, aren't they? Clearly, we've got to an environment now where, you know, there's the bezel shrunk and shrunk. The overall thickness of the panel has diminished over time as, you know, new emerging flat panel technologies have come out. You know, these days there's just so many challenges to actually getting a decent sized set of loudspeakers inside the TV set. At the same time, of course, the screen's also grown. So over time, I think we've seen more and more customer feedback saying, no, the picture's lovely, I enjoy the experience, but the sound is really disappointing. And I think, you know, as people binge watch more and get more involved in kind of high quality viewing than perhaps they maybe did 15, 20 years ago, because there's more accessibility to it in various different streaming platforms, that's only become more exacerbated. So our attempt is to try and, you know, solve that problem if we can. And working with Philips TV, we kind of think we've made some decent progress.
And do you think, before we move on, I know you've got a new range of, you've put your new speaker into the new Philips TV, and we'll come on to that in a moment. Just one further question I wanted to ask while we're talking about what consumers need and stuff. Do you think we've lost touch with the power of sound on our TVs, and that's something that needs to be addressed?
I don't know if they've lost touch. I think, you know, do you know what the first and foremost thing, beyond kind of like scale and bass and power and immersion and all the other things, it's intelligibility. It's just that very simple thing of actually being able to understand what people are saying. I think, you know, you can choose to sort of, you know, if you want to create a home theater experience or fill your room with sound or all that sort of stuff. But at the very, very start of it all, it's not having to turn the thing up to near maximum volume just to be able to understand what people are saying. So I think it's not so much lost touch with sound or the value of sound as become frustrated by the lack of quality within it. I think that's probably the fundamental. I mean, I get so many comments, not only from friends and family, but also from, you know, colleagues within the business that, you know, did you see that thing last night? And I can't understand what was being said. And it's not the mixing engineer's fault, and it's not the studios that are responsible for creating the content. It's the fact that the TV that's being used to display the content has speakers that are roughly the size of a 10 pence coin, or if not smaller, probably mounted on the bottom of the panel, or maybe mounted even on the back of the panel. And that inherently is just not a good start. So kind of separating out beyond, you know, does it make your heart race faster, and does it kind of, you know, shake the room, and yeah, does it kind of wrap you up on the sound experience? It's first and foremost, does it just function as a regular telly should do?
And so this is the second year, and that moves us on to, you know, your collaboration with Philips. This is the second year that's happened. The first year seemed to be, from a consumer point of view, it was a brilliant experience, but it felt that you were trying to work within the confines of Philips televisions. Now it feels the new models, you've been able to sort of branch out. Would that be a fair assumption?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, look, if you looked at some of the other partnerships that we've done in the past, you can draw a very strong parallel with our early experiences in automotive. So essentially, the first and emerging stages of any project, one of the things you're doing is kind of getting to know each other, understanding what each partner in the respective elements of the business has as an expectation, what their requirements are. In the case particularly of the OLED Plus 903, the first set that we worked on, where by the time we'd signed the partnership agreement, most of the fundamentals around industrial design, the outside dimensions of the component and so forth were already defined. So we were coming into a project that was already running and then attempting to try and adapt that project to suit our own intent. And we did make quite a few fundamental changes because we kind of like that. And happily for the, you know, our partnership and, you know, the guys at Philips TV, they were very gracious. They saw the value in those changes and they appreciated the performance advantages, and we were able to incorporate them. I think this year kind of reflects a more mature partnership relationship, because obviously OLED Plus 903 was so well regarded and so successful. the outcome of that is we've been able to do a great deal more right from the start. I think it's much more of a symbiosis, if you like, in the development process. Right at the start, the team from them has said, you know, okay, guys, based on what you've achieved last year, what do you need? What would you like to have in your ideal world if you were going to really advance the art? And I think the separated enclosures, as we refer to them, sort of dedicated loudspeaker spaces that we now have in both models, in the 934 and the 984, are a direct reflection of
that. And do you think is that the sort of bit that you're most excited about, the bit that you're probably most proud of, is that sort of creating the dedicated tweeter speaker in a different, you know, in addition to the loudspeakers as well?
Well, I mean, yeah, absolutely. Look, in lots of ways, loudspeaker engineering isn't rocket science, right? It's just doing logical things by the design. So much like if we were going to create a proper loudspeaker for your home, we would focus first and foremost on the value and the quality of the speaker enclosure before anything else. And the same would apply to your car. The same applies to a TV. I mean, essentially, the more space that we have, the stiffer the enclosure, the better the space, the more optimally placed the drive units are, the better the chance we have of producing something that's going to be really satisfying to listen to. So, and there are obvious reasons when you think about it, that why that makes sense. I mean, first and foremost, if I was going to look at you and talk to you, you stood a much better chance of understanding what I was going to say. If I looked away from you or looked down at my shoes, it would be much harder for you to understand me. And when you think that through, that's entirely what the majority of TV sets today do. They either point the speaker down at the floor, or, you know, into your tabletop, or they point it away from you. So starting with drive units that face forwards, sounds simple, but it's really logical, it makes sense. And then going from there to, okay, let's have a decent sized speaker enclosure, let's really stiffen it up so it doesn't vibrate and resonate. That means we can drive it harder. That means we can get more output from it. And that means also by putting it into its own separated space, we can do all of that without any risk to the performance that we can get from the picture, which clearly, of course, is very important too.
Now, Bowers & Wilkins is known for the Nautilus and amongst other amazing speakers that you guys produce. How much of that technology in a speaker like that trickles down into, you know, some of your smaller sets, some of your smaller speakers, and the experience here?
I mean, everything that we do is what we would call cascade or trickle down of technology that goes into the premium models. If you think about, let's talk about high frequency as just one obvious example. So for quite a period of time now, we've worked on high frequency diaphragms or tweeters that behave pistonically, where we're attempting to try and make sure that the diaphragm doesn't bend or flex or distort in unwanted ways as it moves upwards in frequency. And we've used a variety of different types of material to achieve that. You touched on Nautilus, that uses aluminium. More recently, we've used diamond, as you might be familiar with, in the 800 series diamond. So in the TVs, we're using a very light, smaller, but very high-performance titanium dome. Now, it's the first time we've used that material, but it allows us to get something which is smaller than our standard diaphragm, 19 millimeter as opposed to 25, and still has extremely good, even dispersion and behavior. And that's exactly cascaded thinking from, you know, the premium loudspeakers. And you can take that across the board with almost everything that we're doing. So, you know, decoupling assemblies, using isolating mounts to essentially control vibration and resonance as it moves through the system so that it doesn't pollute the output of a given drive unit with the output of another drive unit. If you go through the 984 in particular, you've got fully decoupled isolated tweeters sitting in fully decoupled isolated enclosures.
Right.
Now, that's exactly what we do in an 800 series diamond loudspeaker. It's literally the same thinking.
And have you found it the other way around? Have you found anything that you've done on some of these, you know, on these sets that has then gone, oh, actually, we can put that into, you know, the high-end speakers in reverse because we've learned the loaders at the same time?
I think one of the really interesting things you always learn when you're space constrained and when you're working with perhaps more budget limitations as well, because let's be clear, these are, you know, a complete TV set for £2,000 and we charge quite a lot more than that for some of our speakers, is you learn to be inventive with the use of materials. So things like the glass-filled ABS constructions that we use to kind of build the enclosures and how to rib those and stiffen those up to make sure that they minimize bending and flexing. That's something that we've applied in a lot of our more affordable products. So I won't say in an 800 series diamond, but certainly in some of the formation products that we do historically in things like the Zeppelin, that's common thinking, that's shared, and it works very effectively. One of the most interesting things we spent some time working on and having to learn on with the 934 in particular is Dolby Atmos, using the angled elevation upward firing drive units. really understanding how to engineer those, because that's the first time that we'd done that, and understanding the differentiation in requirement that you have between them and a more conventional drive unit. It's been a real eye-opener. I can't say that as a result of that we'll commit to putting it into the next generation of premium loudspeaker, but I definitely think we've learned that we can do it and do it well, and probably apply it to other more affordable products within our own portfolio as well.
Now, Dolby Atmos, as you mentioned, is, you know, something that has suddenly not necessarily jumped onto the scene, but it's certainly being very much branded around by a lot of companies, from, you know, loudspeakers to soundbars to even, you know, mobile phones. Do you, how important do you think it is to support that format, and how important is it to sort of, you know, in the sort of improving sound for movies and TV shows?
Twofold answer. So first off, I think any form of immersion helps to control the reality of the environment that you're actually in. Now, if you think about the film experience, you're normally watching something that's intended for use or replay in a theatre or a cinema, depending on what you prefer to call them. And they're very different spaces from your normal front room. Not least of which is that, you know, the speakers in a cinema are typically much farther away from your ear. So creating that sense of a more believable experience by immersing you and wrapping you in the sound, howsoever you choose to do it, has been, you know, the essential element of home cinema for decades now. It used to be, obviously, you know, Dolby Pro Logic, it moved to Dolby Digital, it moved to Surround EX, then it moved to multiple different forms of 7.1, 9.1, and here we are today with Atmos. I think the appealing thing about integrating Atmos into a TV set in the way we've done it is, of course, a lot of people, rightly, for whatever reason, don't want to have, you know, physical speakers dotted around their home. They perhaps don't in particular want to have cables running across the floor to rear speakers. What I find interesting and exciting about Atmos is it creates that sense of immersion, of bringing you into the soundstage without requiring any physical additional componentry. And I think for a lot of people, that's very compelling. The idea of being able to, you know, change the reality of the room that they're in for the period of time whilst they're watching Atmos-enabled content, of course, is quite exciting. And it seems to be a pretty robust technology. You know, we've obviously, as I said, spent some time getting to understand it and make it work to, you know, what we believe are the appropriate standards, which in particular puts a lot of focus on the engineering of the drive unit itself. But having kind of got that far, it seems to add, and it adds not just to obviously Atmos encoded content as well. I should add, we've been you know, using films that are both Atmos encoded and films that are not, and even with, you know, the sort of older movies that we've worked with, you definitely seem to add an extra dimension of, you know, convincing spatial immersion just by having the elevation driving us operating.
Now, the final question I have is probably one looking to the future. Where do you, you know, what big trend are you seeing moving forward in the speaker world that's going to sort of, you know, be the story for 2020?
We can always do better. I think that there are two parts to it. If you look at the tools that we use to measure and to understand today and compared to where we were 15 years ago, the level of genuine knowledge and understanding about the behavior of a structure, of a cabinet, and whatever else is massively improved. So I'm sure in a year's time or 2 years' time or 3 years' time, we'll be looking at the products that we make today and we'll be identifying how we can improve them. So that's what you would expect. That's a more traditional and radical thing, a traditional van radical thing. I think in more in the kind of the radical element, I think presence and pattern recognition is really interesting. You know, a lot of people ask about voice, and I can see that. I mean, you know, I have Alexa at home. I'm sure most people have something like that at home. I don't personally find it a particularly satisfying way to interact with my music. I use it for lots of other things, but not necessarily kind of to change the way I consume music. But I think presence or pattern recognition, so a system that, you know, automatically recognizes that it's you as opposed to your partner or one of your children or whatever it might be, and selects the music that it deems appropriate for you at that point in time and plays it at the level that you typically like to listen to just by you walking in the room. That's quite an interesting idea. Yeah. So almost like removal of work and making it a bit more magic. So that's the idea. So making it a bit more seamless. I think if we could do one thing to kind of really advance people's enjoyment of music, we've done tremendously, I think, as a business and as an industry over the course of the past 15 years by making streaming services more accessible, by making getting the song that you want in an instant, as opposed to having to, you know, think about it and go down the record shop, whatever it might be. So in lots and lots of ways, the joy of access to music is massively increased. The last step in the chain is to then make that accessible to really high quality devices as easily as it's accessible to you on your phone or your iPad or whatever it might be. And I think presence and pattern is probably one of the interesting ways that we should look to try and do that.
The Motorola Razr is back. 15 years after it first burst onto the stage, Moto has brought the classic clamshell back to the shops, but this time with a foldable display instead of those Tron-esque keys. But does it work? Is it any good? And will it be your next smartphone? Mike Lowe has already played with a new device that's out next year and is here to tell us more. So, Mike, what do you think?
I think it's really exciting. So, I mean, over the last few years, we've had, you know, incremental phones, haven't we? It's just been,
yeah,
here's a phone, here's another phone. This one is the flip phone kind of reimagined. So you've probably seen some foldable phones, and this very much works in the same way. But the thing about the Razr is, as the original, which is 15 years ago, it ultimately folds in half. So imagine you've got a smartphone, but it's then half the size and becomes this kind of tiny little thing with a screen on the front. So you've got this kind of two ways of using it, with this little screen that you can see your notifications and so on, and you can just flip it open, full-size phone, and continue off from there, from what you see on the front. So it's just a very, it's like a really different way of thinking, particularly at the moment. And I think given how foldables have been like a really hot topic, this does things in just such a different way, because it's not a Samsung Galaxy Fold. It's not trying to be a tablet. It's not the Huawei Mate X, you know, it's doing things in a different way, in a way that's modern, but also, as you said, it seems sort of nostalgic, because it's effectively bringing back a phone that is, you know, 10 to 15 years old.
Yeah, I mean, we covered the first Motorola Razr when I first started Pocket Lint back in 2003. So, you know, it feels like, you know, I remember an old boss of mine saying, if you wait long enough, everything comes full circle. And it feels somewhat that is. So I have questions, lots of questions, and I'm sure our listeners do. But unfortunately, they don't have it's not a live phone in, so they don't have the ability to phone in. Yeah. So I'm going to try and ask them for them. So when it's folded up, like, how big is it? Like, is it a bar of soap? Is it thick? Like, how big is it in that sense?
So it's, you know, obviously it's, in essence, it's twice the size that a phone could be, but they've been quite scrupulous about getting it down to a sensible enough size. So if I remember right, I think it's under 14 millimeters. So think about a normal phone is usually about 8.5. So it's certainly thicker. But when you unfold it, that thickness doesn't totally go away, because it still has the full thickness around the chin, as they call it, down the bottom.
Right.
But I don't think it matters that much. Like, it sounds big, but then when you hold it, it feels really small, because it just kind of is, you know, it's like a little, I don't know, it's like a little nugget. It's so much smaller than a normal phone that you're used to holding.
And when you've opened it up fully, are we talking sort of like iPhone 11 size screen? Are we talking sort of, you know, some of these monster Samsung, you know, S10 size screens?
Well, it's fairly small. So it's a 6.2 inch screen, which is 21:9 aspect ratio. So it's a bit thinner, and it's like what you'd see a Hollywood movie being, if you know what I mean. So it gives it that kind of really easy to hold in one hand kind of sense. And because when you've unfolded it, you've got half the thickness in the main body. So it feels really natural to hold it, and you don't really notice that bigger chin, because it kind of sits out the way, and you don't interact with that chin either. Once you've opened it up, you've still got the normal Android keys at the bottom, which I thought would be a bit of a problem. I thought that chin would get in the way, but having used it doesn't. It feels completely fine.
And in terms of the balance and stuff, once you've then folded it, does it sort of lock into place? Is there a sense that you've then got a phone that you're used, like most people will be used to using over the last 10 years?
They talked about this a lot. So they've put a lot of work into kind of how this whole thing operates. And I think the problem we've seen with some flexible displays, particularly on the Samsung, is you get this kind of crease down the middle. With the Moto, when you unfold it, they've kind of developed this system where these kind of metal plates slide up, and it just stabilizes the screen. It keeps it like completely solid. You can't see a crease at all. And yeah, it feels solid. Like it's actually really quite impressive on that front. And there's no sort of fiddling around with buttons to get it open. There's no like lock key or anything like that. And when you fold it shut, you can just snap it shut. It's a tiny bit fiddly to open it in the first place, but other than that, it just feels it feels really well thought out. You know, it works. It just works.
And did you have a Razer back in the day, so to speak? Were you a clamshell user?
I never actually owned one, but they were everywhere. So I always saw them. I'm trying to think who would have had one that I knew, but
I had loads of clamshells all the way through from, I had the Razer for a while. I had the Sony Ericsson V800, which was like this monster. It was the first 3G phone, so it kind of, and then I think shifted to candy bars and Blackberries and all those kind of things going on.
A hardcore Nokia user for quite a long time. And that just kind of stuck, that easy method of use. I was used to the keypad and whatever, but the Razer originally did have a keypad, and obviously this one doesn't. You know, it's you fold it, unfold it, and you've just got a full touchscreen, which it uses plastic OLED, which is PoLED, as some people might say, which is what all these foldable screens have to use, because they can't be glass, obviously, because it cannot fold. Small problem with PoLED is it's a little bit reflective, but it's kind of one of the small compromises you have to pay to have that foldable screen. And just watching it fold is kind of amazing in its own way, you know, because it completely flexes. And you see this little curve down the center as you're doing it. You can actually like press that and flex it with your thumb if you want to. You probably shouldn't, but it's kind of satisfying just seeing this technology completely operational and like in your hand.
And so the negatives here, are you paying, I know they're expensive or expected to be expensive when they come out in 2020. Is this device, is it gimmick? Do you really need it to be folding?
Does anything need to fold? You know, it's something just cool about it. It's not entirely necessary, but I think the way I was kind of looking at it is, in a sense, it's kind of like, so I don't wear a watch. And if I was to, say, have an iPhone, I'd get an Apple Watch. With this phone, because you've got the glance screen on the front, which is like a 2.7-inch screen, it's really small. But that's almost like your Apple Watch sort of peek into the world of phone. And you don't have to open it until you want to sort of go a step beyond that. So it'll stop you kind of constantly just thumbing around a phone screen for no particular reason. So I kind of like that idea. I think it's a bit, it's a different approach in that way. You could just leave it sat on the desk and, you know.
Kind of almost like the digital well-being sort of element of a phone.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, but also there's some satisfaction in just opening and closing it. So you might be doing that all the time. that was always a fidget thing with the original one. So, I mean, yes, it also is expensive. US is about $1,500 if you were to buy it. I would say SIM free, but that's not the case because it's an eSIM and you can only get it on Verizon. In the UK, we know it's launching on EE. We don't know more information yet. Given how bad the pound is against the dollar, I wouldn't be surprised if it was the same in pounds. So it's probably going to be £1,500.
But then, I know that's expensive. We've kind of got to a point now where, flagship phones are all £1,000 anyway. And as you say, you are buying something that's not out there. It's kind of, the Samsung Galaxy Fold, which Chris has been using and has also really enjoyed, is a very, very different proposition. So
that's like a tablet, effectively. And also that's even more, that's £1,900. And then the Huawei, I think, is around €2,200. So this is kind of the cheapest one. And for me, it's the most successful way of putting a folding screen into something, because you don't get the crease. It just makes sense and it just works. There are some small compromises that I haven't mentioned, actually, though, because it is limited in size. They've had to be quite conservative with the battery. So the battery's in two parts and they've balanced it so it feels really balanced and well weighted, however you're holding it. But the size of the battery is sort of maybe 2/3 that you would get in a standard flagship. And that's potentially going to cost how long it lasts for. So we'll have to see. But I can't yet comment on exactly how well it'll perform in that term.
And so the final question, will you be excited to get one? Are you looking forward to review one? I know I wouldn't ask you whether you'd want to buy one because you haven't actually had a chance to play with one for a huge amount of time yet. But overall, are you confident and excited that this is the future?
Yeah, because I see phones all the time, right? And a lot of them are really interesting, but this one is just so different. It's exciting. It's the first time that I've seen something that different for years, right? So it just feels like this technology we've been talking about for so long has actually happened in a way that is feasible and does work. So yeah, I'm excited. It'll be really interesting to see when it comes out in January.
That's it for this week. If you've enjoyed the show, can you please give us a 5-star rating on the podcast platform you're listening on? It really will help raise our profile and let others know you liked it too. Until next Friday, pip pip.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.